Laat me je voorstellen aan Pim Verlaan.
Begin op een hele jonge leeftijd met beleggen. Die horizon die jij hebt, gaat zoveel voordeel opleveren.
En Pim is een man met een missie. Iedereen veilig en verantwoord leren beleggen.
Als je echt iets wil leren, leer dat van iemand die één stapje vooruit loopt.
Hij legt je uit op welke manieren je kan beleggen.
Elke bank heeft eigenlijk zijn eigen beleggingsfonds. Ik hou daar helemaal niet van.
Op welke manieren je beter kan beleggen. En hij rekent je voordeel op de euro nauwkeurig uit.
192.000 euro minder rendement.
Zelf leren beleggen.
Niemand vertelt dit.
Pim dus wel. In Jong Beleggen, de podcast.
Nou, dat is toch fantastisch.
The most important lesson I learned is never say it will never happen. If you have a dream, it will happen. Don't be scared, especially if somebody is older than you, tells you, I listened too many times to this story, and it was the young people having the right answer, not the old people. I think for many important reasons, we have partly lost our capacity to dream. And that a little bit explains a little the problems we are having in finding the big next thing. But the big next thing is with us.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Jansen.
Hello, welcome to episode 78 of Betrouwbare Bronnen, or in English, Reliable Sources or even Trusted Sources. This time I have a European guest, so we will talk English. My very distinguished guest is an Italian-European, Roberto Viola, Director General of the European Commission for Communications, Networks, Content and Technology, the digital man of Europe. I will have a conversation with him on the progress Europe makes in the digital sphere. Are we running fast enough? Or in some ways lagging behind? And because this is a Dutch podcast, where are the Netherlands in shaping the digital future? We also talk about geopolitics and about ethical dilemmas.
Dit is Jaap Jansen met Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welcome to our podcast, Roberto Viola. Before we start, in your curriculum vitae, I read that you worked from 1986 till 1999, 13 years at the European Space Agency,
yes.
In Noordwijk.
Noordwijk, yes.
And you have some language skills in Dutch.
Well, I would say I even went into a formal university course of Dutch, but my Dutch is now a bit rusty.
Yeah, rustig in
yes,
Nederlands.
Rustig.
Yeah. So we shall talk English.
Unfortunately, but if you want, next time with good training, we do it in Dutch as well.
What did you do at the ESA in Noordwijk?
Well, I arrived, I was really a boy, a young, enthusiastic boy looking at space as something I've seen in TV when the moon landing, I come from the prehistory in a way. And when I arrived there, it was a bit the dream of my life. To contribute for something that mankind doesn't know and how to do it. And so I started as a researcher, and I worked in advanced communication system for satellites, for deep space probes. And then I moved into more management positions, looking satellites, how to bring at that time the digital revolution. We were at the beginning of the digital revolution. So it was such an important, refreshing experience. You know why? Because all what we use today, the GPS, the image compression, comes from space.
Yeah.
Comes from space research. So I was blessed by the possibility to see it 20 years before it really happened. That still gives me a little competitive advantage.
So more or less we can say you were at the start of the revolution.
In a way, yes, you can say that. I didn't make a penny out of it, but found the very, very important companies, but I was at that start, yes.
And what was the most important lesson you learned in Noordwijk?
You mean in terms of living in the Netherlands?
No, no, no. I mean, of course. You were at the start of the digital era, and now you are the digital man of the European Commission.
You know what is the... I think the question, the $1 billion or $1 million question. The most important lesson I learned is never say it will never happen. You know this skepticism that is around research and development. Because it is nice in a dinner or in a meeting, say, "Oh, it will never happen. Don't worry." I heard it, believe it or not, for the internet. Now we might laugh at it, but I was in a meeting as a very energetic enthusiast about this new way of making connections. I was really part of the team which was testing those connections. And I was called by a board of a very important telecom company to make a presentation. I made my presentation, said this is really revolutionary. And people were quite distracted. You could see, you could tell from their faces and their body posture. At the end of the presentation, the chair of the meeting said, "You say that's fine, but you know, dear boy, we do here very serious things. We don't do the internet." This is literally what I was told. Big disappointment.
Internet wasn't a serious thing.
No, it was considered something for the geeks, something for, I mean, the
for nerds.
The nerds, exactly. Something for, I mean, that really would never change the course of something. And I also remember when a very famous phone company, which at that time was the phone, the cell phone company, you might understand which company I'm referring to in Europe, a very important manager told me smartphones will never be on the market. Again, we might smile now, but I mean, we do serious stuff here. We do good phones. Those kind of things will never be important in the market. So my first point, which I learned over and over, never think for a split second that you know what is going to happen tomorrow. Disruption is behind the corner. And the seeds of this disruption, we have it in front of us, and most of the time we don't recognize them.
So in your younger days, digitalization was something for some nerds in the corner of the building?
Yes, yes.
And now, but now digitalization is everywhere.
You might remember, in the Netherlands, there were the computer fairs. They were going around in various places, and you were going there to buy the pieces of the computer. We were very well attended, all nerds, but very well attended. And I was there with others, buying pieces of memories, processor, and assembling computer, and making this as a kind of present to the friends. I mean, this was it sounds really long time ago, not such a long time ago, 20 years ago. I mean, so it's impressive, I mean, how things moved and moved quickly, I mean.
Yeah, I remember at the weekly where I worked as a young journalist with one colleague, I was the only one who had a computer at his desk, and all the other ones used typewriters still.
Exactly. And I remember when I was at Estec, when arrived the first word processor, I mean, and the first internal mailing system. It was quite a thing. And you might remember this big fair in Utrecht at that time. Every time, I think it was November, I mean, it was the big thing. And the memory, 1 megabyte of memory, the price was 100 guilders at that time.
Ah, yeah. Yeah.
So...
And
now you buy
nowadays you throw it in the waste bin.
Yes, exactly.
If you get 1 megabyte.
Exactly. Unfortunately, yeah. You should not throw these kind of things in the waste bin. But this is maybe something we will discuss during our conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
The electronic waste. So never say never. And I have a long list of people laughing at OLEDs, laughing at navigation, GPS, and then the European navigation, laughing at the idea, as I told you, smartphones, Wi-Fi will never be relevant. The list is very long.
Yeah. You talked about the first man on the moon. I remember it myself also. Since then, digitalization has become very huge, but there are no travels to the moon every month or so.
We are
to Mars.
This is something we did not anticipate. You know, when the men landed on the moon, I remember people were in newspapers and everywhere. When the men will land on Mars, it will be the next one. And then outside the solar system. Unfortunately, space exploration turned to be a very expensive hobby for the human being and complicated. And then we had all sorts of energy crises, all sorts of problems with the public budgets. So our space ambitions collectively as world has been starting to scale down. But at the same time, there's been such an impressive acceleration of the digital revolution, which was not expected, not foreseen, which everything has changed since then. But
So we can say thanks to the man on the moon, we have the
thanks
iPhone.
Thanks to the man on the moon. Yes, but absolutely. The gyroscope. You know, the gyroscope is the thing that allows you to see the screen in one horizontal or vertical position. This is part of the Apollo mission. I mean, the idea of the microprocessor. There was a lot what we today call artificial intelligence in the system that was landing the spacecraft. I mean, all this algorithm, the mathematics is still that mathematics. Now we have the data, we have the computing. But so when we have a big challenge, when we dream, we have a game changer. And that's a little bit the problem of where we stand now. I think for many important reasons, we have partly lost our capacity to dream, and that a little bit explains a little the problems we are having in finding the big next thing. But the big next thing is with us. That's the other thing, which, for instance, when you take the idea of having our digital brother, our digital twin, this is, I mean, again, something maybe you don't take me seriously. I'm sure a few years from now you will go to your family doctor with your digital brother. And it will be your digital brother, the guinea pig, not you. So maybe testing something, maybe looking at what is the effect on your genome. So that's a bit the idea now, that we are more and more having kind of parallel worlds, the digital world and the real world, and the two work very nicely together to deliver you an experience in terms of life, which is absolutely unprecedented. This is the next thing after landing on the moon.
Yeah.
And then when you...
The digital brother, I didn't think about
we call it,
so far.
We call it in general digital twins. You have an object and you have this digital copy. You have yourself, you have a digital copy. You have the Earth, you have a copy of the Earth. And these are extremely useful twins because you can play with them without damage, I mean. Whilst normally it's not that nice when they tell you, well, it's an experimental medicine. Would you like to try it?
Yeah. So talking about a digital copy of the Earth, I think we can use that while having the new European Green Deal.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the... we still have to learn many things about our future on the Earth. And the problem is learning means using very complex mathematical models and data and using satellites. Now, Europe happens to have the best Earth observation satellites. Again, a product of ESTEC. I mean, it's in the European space. LED initiative. It's a commission initiative where the European Space Agency is the main partner. And those satellites generate terabytes and terabytes of data about our Earth. Now, with the computers, artificial intelligence, we can go very far in understanding things. So this is an example. The other example is us. I mean, we have launched this genomic alliance where we want everybody in Europe to cooperate in putting together the understanding of our genomes. So how, for instance, we can observe certain genetic variation in certain illnesses. And again, the possible variation of the genomes are millions and millions and millions. So you need to be many, and you need very, very powerful machines.
So in a way, we ourselves come closer to God.
Well, I mean, that becomes very, very religious as, or very philosophical as a discussion. Depends on your definition. What is your definition of God? I will give you mine. Then.
Well, many people think of God as the inventor of everything, you and I, the world surrounding us. But now, with all those digital tools, in a way, we can become more or less partially a little bit God ourselves.
Well, I mean, if this what, this is not a bad definition, which I would subscribe, being, let's say, shaping everything. I think what we struggle to shape, and that's where we have need to reconcile the digital world with the real one, is that in a way how our society is organized and how our society can profit from all this. Because we, of course, concentrated a lot so far on the bright side of the story. But there's also a bit of a darker side when it comes, for instance, how digital can be exploited to actually create social unrest, to actually create division, or create inequalities, and that we don't want.
Yeah.
So, and those little gods are not really welcome in our society. So I think we like the society of our nice digital brothers. We hate the Orwellian society of our big brothers.
Yeah, that's. But in many parts of the world, it isn't like Europe, a democracy. There are some people who have all the tools and are more or less handling like dictators. It's not a nice idea that they have all those things also.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, you said it and I can only underline it. I think we are a bit special as Europeans. I think there's no other place in the world where democracy comes with a capital D, where human rights come with a capital H, and where we have a vision that technology should help people, should not be against people. I think this is extremely powerful. Where we are a bit weaker is when it comes to how to reconcile this vision, which is in a way the perfect vision how things should be, on a pragmatic way of saying, okay, but technology is still important. I mean, you cannot just talk about it. There, we are much weaker. And one of the reasons we are much weaker is that, of course, it would be much nicer that if we would be a team, a real team. I mean, I always used to say, I mean, look, I mean, you play football 11 against 11, we can even cheat and play football 27 against 11. That makes a difference. And, of, and on things like, I mean, the new efforts like, I mean, artificial intelligence, efforts like, I mean, having a control of quantum technologies, these are two big things for even the biggest member state of Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
These are things which are global. The game is the World Cup. You don't go to the World Cup being one player. You will never win the World Cup. And that's something we should avoid as a mistake.
Can we in Europe go fast enough digitalizing our world? I mean, a dictator can say to his people, we walk that way and everyone walks that way. In Europe, we have to talk and talk.
But you know, one of the reasons could be, this is, again, as the two sides, the weakness and the strength. First of all, we will never oblige people to be part of socially controlled programs in order to be better. That will never happen, and thanks God, it will never happen in Europe.
I agree.
So I'm not even interested to play that game. So we will have to turn this, that could be, if you like, a potential weakness. Again, looking at the football analogy, somebody that cheats, that kicks the players, that doesn't respect the rules and is not seen by the referee, which is unfair. But if you're stronger, you are stronger. You have even stronger of people not respecting the rules. So how to turn this, which I cannot call it a handicap, this structural way of being, which I like, into something which is our collective strength, I think it's something I wake up every day and I think about it. Because if we can do that, then it would be marriage in heaven. I mean, human-centric approach and at the same time being strong technologically. Now, is it possible? I think, frankly, it is possible. It is possible. Yeah. And I can give you examples where it's possible. Yeah.
Europe has to cope with China. In the Netherlands, at this moment, there's a debate because ASML has a very, very good chip machine and China wants to buy it. And now the Americans say to the Dutch government, don't let ASML sell that chip machine to China. What do you think is the best thing to do?
Well, I don't know now the specifics of this case, so I cannot comment this case. What I can say in general is that Europe remains open, but at the same time, it's very concerned about guarding intellectual property rights, guarding technologies, and, I mean, in this respect, we have put in place a trade defense instrument where we are looking at screening, I mean, what can be done, what cannot be done, collectively with the member state. The member state do have also this possibility. So I think more and more Europe will be attentive to two elements which are very important, the security elements, so our systems must be secure, our resilience must be at the highest possible level. And the other element will be, in case of acquisitions, Europe must have the reflex in checking what are the implications.
Yeah, so we have to be warned that all the things we invent are not stolen from us. There's a dilemma, because in science, you want to have open sources, as many open sources as can be possible. But there's also the thing of I invent a thing and others may not copy it for their own use.
Yeah, but that's a bit, as you say, in science and technology, this has been always the dilemma. It remains the dilemma. I said it before. I mean, for us, the respect of democracy, the respect of human rights is very important. And I think this will always put in front, I mean, of whatever other considerations. And I would say rightly so. The other element, which is very clear, we are guarding our intellectual property right, what our companies are doing, not because, I mean, we have a kind of protectionist reflex, because, I mean, the history proves exactly the opposite. It is because we would like to have a very strong economy that fuels the very strong social system we have. The welfare system of Europe, again, is a crown jewel, it's a rather unique setup in the world, but of course, it's expensive. And we need an economy that generates value. And you are saying, I cannot agree more, the more we look at the future, the more this value looks digital. So these are the reasons why we say defense. Defense of European values, defense of the fact that we need to generate growth and wealth for our citizens. And in turn, we have to maintain, I mean, what are the crown jewels of this system. So this should not be confused with protectionism. protectionism always leads to inefficiency of the economic system. Here we are talking about, instead, generating growth, being ethical, and being, in the forefront of social innovation.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Last week, Angela Merkel, the Bundeskanzler, had an interview in the Financial Times, and she said two things. Europe is no longer at the center of world events, and also Europe must have the crucial technological capabilities. Are we now, in some parts of our digital economy, lagging behind some other parts of the world?
Well, I mean, what the Chancellor of Germany said, it was already said by our President Ursula von der Leyen in the programmatic speech she made and the political guidelines, that Europe must have control of the key future technologies. For the reasons I think she well explained, I mean that she cares of economy fit for the people and a wealthy future for Europe. Yes, Europe is not in the forefront when it comes, for instance, to some of the most important advancements. For instance, we have some work to do when it comes to electronic components. Basic electronic components. We had some work to do when it comes to supercomputing. We are catching up, but not totally there. We are not bad in terms of basic knowledge in terms of quantum technologies, but we have to do a lot of work to be on the forefront. AI revolution is just at the very beginning, but we can do a lot. But there's one thing that should be very clear. We have plenty of talent, plenty of resources, plenty of companies, people that can make the difference. So, and also one other thing that should be clear, we have still, to see the future. You quoted the interview of the Chancellor. There's an interview of Commissioner Breton that clearly says the future is in our hand, the data of the future are yet to be generated. We have a lot to do and a lot of possibilities and a lot of cards to play.
Yeah, that's Thierry Breton, the Commissioner for Internal Market.
Indeed.
And you, as the digital man,
my commission,
you are serving more than one commissioner.
Well, I mean, my reference commissioner is Mr. Breton, and then we are part of the remit of Vice President Vestager, which is the digital, Europe digital, fit for the digital future. And of course, we are serving the president.
Yeah.
My point is, this model has delivers a lot for the citizens. It is true that this model might create less revenues or less margin for the telecom companies. And I think, as in everything, we have to find the right equilibrium between, pushing for the ultimate competition when it comes to prices and services, but at the same time allowing some space for companies to do the investments.
Yeah, to have innovation.
And to innovate. And frankly, as in every other jurisdiction, we are always in search of this equilibrium because things do change. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, maybe the most important thing was to phone, and the geeks were using internet. Now, for everybody, the most important thing is broadband access to the internet. Phone, nice, but there are many other ways. Look at the younger generations. My daughter rarely phones. So things have changed very much. Have we done this adaptation in terms of telecom rules? I think we tried seriously. Last year we had a complete overhaul of the telecom rules, but still there's a long way to go.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
Talking about telecom, in 2016 there was a European action plan for 5G, in which was stated that before the end of 2020, this year, at least one city in every member state should have a complete 5G network. Will you reach that goal this year?
I'm afraid we will not. But at the same time, we will be quite close, in the sense that many important European cities, they have 5G. There's 5G in Madrid, 5G in Milan and Rome, 5G in Berlin.
Not so, in Holland yet?
Yes, I know. And this is not nice. If you think a second about the Netherlands, I understand that from now on we have to say the Netherlands.
Yes, yeah, that's a new instruction we had from the government.
We call it the Netherlands. If you look at the Netherlands and what we publish every year, what we call it DESI Index, where we measure the advancement of the digital society and economy, the Netherlands is scoring very well. But if you look inside those numbers, you see that when it's the most advanced, well, the most advanced parameters we measure, which is the readiness for 5G, the number of fiber connection, the use of big data by companies, the Netherlands is not scoring well.
Oh.
The Netherlands has a lot of work to do. I wouldn't say it has been sitting down on the glory and forgetting that, again, if we continue using, sport and football as an analogy, you have to train and get new blood every time.
We always think in the Netherlands we are very modern and we are very digital.
Exactly. I know, and you are very proud of it. Rightly so, by the way, because also we compare with the rest of the world that the Netherlands is advanced. But you have to look now in perspective. And in perspective, there are some signs which are slightly worrying. The most important one is this delay in 5G in terms of organizing the spectrum, releasing the frequencies, which, frankly, that is not good. The other delay is in getting the possibility for people to have the ultra broadband, the 1 gigabit per second connections. I think there's some catch-up work. Also, when it comes, to use much more intensively big data, to use data.
Is there a reason for this lagging behind from the Netherlands?
Well, I think I would say the reason, we come back to one of your questions, the reason is that everybody in the Netherlands is very attentive, rightly so, to spending, being public spending or company investments. And this prudence, it's the wisdom and the strength of the Netherlands, but at the same time can become a little bit the part where you slow down a little bit. So I think overall the system should dare a little bit more. And probably there's also another reason, which is maybe there should be a bit more fluid governance of the digital things, because as you know, in the Netherlands, it's not the same regulator, the spectrum, and the rest of the telecom. By the way, the telecom regulator in the Netherlands is merged with the competition regulator. So maybe also this creates a little bit of a slowness in getting decision. The decision of the Netherlands in general are excellent. So, don't get me wrong. I'm sure the Netherlands will get there. I think it would be better sooner than later.
Yeah. In the Netherlands, there is a discussion about a new investment fund with maybe 50 billion euro, maybe even up to 100 billion euro for long-term investments. Can that help a thing like 5G?
Definitely. Because if there's something which is long-term, but very, very important, because it changes the shape of a country, as we were discussing, it's 5G, it's advanced broadband. So these are the things which they have a bit of a dip in cash flows, but then over time they repay. So I think digital infrastructures are a prime candidate for a fund like this.
Yeah. Earlier we talked about China. Nowadays, Huawei says to the Netherlands, we can give you a very nice 5G system. Shall we invite them to come and to implement it?
Look, on 5G, what we have done, we have told the member states, let's work together on the issue of security. Let's analyze the risks. Let's assess what is the situation. So the first thing is the approach of Europe is risk-based assessment. We are not in the business of looking at particular companies, but we are in the business of looking at risk. The second point being, we have already published an analysis which has been agreed by all member states, which is, are there risks about 5G? And the answer is yes.
And there's also a China strategy of the European Union?
There's a China strategy. But now, concentrating on 5G, we have published a document which is the risk assessment. What we are busy right now, we are working with the member states on something which is called the toolbox. So, risks are published. What kind of remedies we can find to the risks? And this is, again, a work that we are doing with the member states. We will publish soon this toolbox, and there you will have all the answers.
Yeah. So that will be here in a few weeks or months?
I would say more weeks than months.
And that also will help the member states and the companies in the member states to work together?
This is done with the member states. So this is our joint assessment.
Yeah.
Member states and the Commission working together.
Yeah. This is about China, but there are also some problems with the United States.
No, but the toolbox is not about one country or the other. The toolbox is risks published, what kind of remedies we can find.
Well, there are also some problems with companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, very big companies who sometimes have half of, or more than half of the market power. How do we cope with that?
First of all, whoever operates in Europe has to respect the rules of Europe, which include competition law. So you might have noticed that the European Commission is very determined to make sure that competition law is respected.
Yeah, and Commissioner Vestager already has put some fines now, on those companies.
And the Commissioner, when she was Competition Commissioner, now she has even a greater role in leading the Vice President, as a Vice President for Digital Economy and Competition Commissioner. And the European Commission has always used, in the interest of the citizens and a well-functioning market, the powers that are given by the treaty. And as you know, I mean, we have looked very carefully at some cases which are about digital economy. And still, there are cases about digital economy. So this is one thing that...
Are the penalties high enough? In Holland, one of the governing parties, D66, questions that and says the penalties have to be higher. And, well, we have to think about three strikes, you're out. If you do wrong things for the third time and get for the third time a penalty, then it's over and done with your company in Europe.
I wish life would be that simple. One has a sword and it goes around. I mean, first of all, the penalties are high and they can get even higher. And, I mean, there's an increasing amount of remedies that competition law allow to be taken. But, of course, I said it before and I repeat, we are the land of rule of law. So we have to apply the law, in our case the treaty, and make sure that all we do is proportionate. The companies have the right to reply, the right to defend. And once we have taken a decision, we have to see the effects of this decision. So, of course, you can always escalate. But even more important, I think what we want to achieve is good behavior in the market. That's why One thing is the competition power. The other one is the possibility also, which has the Commission, to propose rules and then for the European institution to adopt rules. Important rules we have adopted in Europe are the so-called platform to business rules, which is a regulation that speaks about the fairness which platforms should have towards businesses, especially small businesses. And there, this is a very new regulation. We have said many things, like, I mean, if you are a small business, you need to be informed. Contractual conditions cannot change overnight if you are not informed. If, the business relationship changes, you should have your say. You should have your say about how your trade data are treated. You should have a place to complain. You should have access to justice in Europe in an effective but not very expensive way, if necessary. So these are things which are in this new regulation. So one thing is the market force. The other thing is also how to behave on the market and how to make sure we have a good equilibrium between the small and the big.
Is it still possible to produce a European equivalent of companies like Facebook, Google, Apple?
Yes, why not? I mean, why not? We said it at the beginning of this very nice chat. Europe was a bit slow in recognizing the strength and the transformative power of the internet, slower than clearly the US. And what happened is that especially in the Silicon Valley, there was a fertile ground for entrepreneurs to launch their ideas. Now, we are at the beginning of the digital era. We are just at the beginning.
We ain't seen nothing yet.
We have seen very little, frankly. People will laugh when they will see our phones or our bulky scene for virtual reality in 100 years from now. So this will be pieces staying in a museum, and there will be something else. And on this something else, I'm sure that there will be a European contribution, a very strong one. So the story is here to be written, I mean.
Yeah. One of the problems in cyberspace are the cyber attacks. In the last few weeks in the Netherlands, I pronounced it right, the Netherlands, not in Holland anymore, the Maastricht University was hacked.
Yes.
And also a company called TravelX and some other systems were threatened by hacks. That's a very strong thing if you cannot use your university equipment for 2 weeks or so.
Indeed, my daughter studied at Maastricht University, by the way.
Congratulations.
It's a very nice city and a very nice university. And I all my solidarity to the university and the companies which are affected by this. It's a very, 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 I am saying very five, I should say 100 times, very important problem for Europe. For the world that cares about, again, protecting companies and citizens, because the more we are a digital society, the more we are exposed to this kind of risks. And we are a little bit kids in this. You always remind kids to do certain things, to avoid to do certain things. And here, again, we are at the very beginning. People, that's what are called.
Sometimes we still have the password from 10 years ago.
Exactly. And, I was about to say.
The same password for everything.
Yeah, or the dog is the password, or whatever. The name of the daughter or the wife. I'm not suggesting that the people listening, we should put this password. On the contrary.
My mother always uses her very first telephone number.
Okay. Look, we call it a cyber hygiene. So people know that they have to wash their hands. People should know the same type of precaution should be taken in the digital world. People should not trust whatever email arrives to them. Yesterday night, I got an email So I normally should be considered a very savvy cyber expert. You haven't paid this bill. And my first reaction was about to open the, and there's an invoice attached. And it was exactly company I paid 1 month ago with very credible information. And I got upset because I said, come on, I paid. So what, I was about to click, and then I said, let me check. And below the name, there was an email address, which not was not there. For that company had been hacked, took my email, the information, and they engineered an email to me, which was absolutely credible. So that's the problem. This is called social engineered attack. They are becoming, these criminals, much more sophisticated. They combine knowing what you do with your digital habits. So that's the first defense can only be us. I mean, being savvy, changing the password, looking at what we open, making sure that we use files only from trusted sources and protect our devices. This is the first thing, but this is not enough.
When I look in my spam box of my mail at this moment, I see 6 mails. They are almost all phishing mails.
Yes, yes. But and
luckily, they are in the spam box.
Yeah, but sometimes they are not intercepted. So this is the first thing, being much more savvy ourselves. Then, I mean, for companies, is to develop a corporate culture about cybersecurity. Cybersecurity should be a C-level worry. There must be a plan. There must be, I mean, expertise. And it can, managers cannot close their eyes. It's a risk that must be taken into account. And then for public organization, for countries, and here we come also as European Commission, we must really be sure that we have a system in Europe that cooperates. Because, I mean, one of the most important things in cybersecurity is that there should be a fast exchange of information. We are under attack. So that the attack does not propagate. It's a little bit like a virus. I mean, if you don't know, then things spread very quickly. If you know, you start to take measures. Yeah. So knowing is acting. And that's where, I mean, we have been working. There's a directive which is called NIS, Network Information Security Directive. But, I mean, this is just the beginning of working together. So we must be much more attentive. And this is about the criminals. But also there's another dimension, which is there are state actors which have an interest to attack European interest or assets. And this also we must be very careful, very attentive.
Yeah, yeah. You talked already a little bit about artificial intelligence in the mission letter of the new commission. It's also being talked about artificial intelligence and about looking at how we can use and share non-personalized big data to develop new technologies and business models. Does it mean that also businesses should hand over their big data for the common good?
It doesn't say that, the mission letter. I think on data, artificial
intelligence. That's why I ask it.
Yes, yeah. No, no. Indeed. And that's where we need to have a very clear line. That's why, I mean, on data and artificial intelligence, we will say very clearly in the coming weeks what the Commission thinks about how, I mean, data should be managed in Europe. This was announced by Mr. Breton. What we will happen in terms of what we think about how we want to approach the issues about artificial intelligence, and also this to start a dialogue with everybody interested that can give us a little bit of feedback. So these are issues where it doesn't make any sense that, Commission takes some sort of resolution alone, in isolation. It's very important that every component of the society gives feedback on things which we are discussing since now, what, half an hour? These are existential things for our future. So the minimum we have to do, and more than the minimum, is really what we want to do, is to make sure that everybody is involved, everybody can give feedback. We are not coming from zero. I mean, we have been working with the best experts of the world in artificial intelligence. They have produced a report with some principles. So there's a lot of now good thinking out there. But now we need to go to the next step, so which is reflect what kind of rules we want in the future in Europe, and this reflection should be done all together.
Yeah. Another thing, many companies in Europe are struggling to hire new ICT staff. What's the solution to this problem? Companies need more digital skilled personnel, but absolutely, there isn't enough of it.
This is something which, you know, I call it one of the biggest European paradox. The paradox being, especially in South Europe, in Spain or in Italy, you have many people without a job. So the level of youth employment, you take Spain, is above 20%. So you have many young people without a job and many jobs without young people. That's the digital paradox.
Yeah.
And why so? I mean, why? How is possible? I mean, so many people looking for a job, but so many jobs looking for people. I think the answer is not rocket science. It's mismatch between what these people know and what the market wants. So we have a generation problem. We have a problem which, if we don't manage well, can even amplify the kind of idea that all of this is bad. I mean, everybody's against, the people, and leads easily into populism, into simplification, into things which are not the good way of being together. So we have to be sure that this generation is not a lost generation, that this is a generation that really can enter the job market. So here we come, skills. We need to make sure that the education system adapts to the new need. Primary education, secondary education, universities. We need to make sure that people understand it. I mean, so talking about generation, this is a generation project, but it starts with, some issues which we cannot delay anymore. And this also applies to companies. I think it's too simple and too unacceptable, if you like. I have a new technology. I have a kind of margin to make, so I fire the people. This is cheap, wrong, and this is not showing good corporate responsibility. I think what should be the reflex is that every company should be much more committed in retraining, training on the job, letting people acquiring digital skills. It's in the company's interest, in the society interest.
Yeah. So sometimes maybe they forget that it is in the company's interest.
Yeah, but this is when we were saying, I mean, people not seeing the future in terms of technology. There's another very common thing that happens, that people don't see when something leads to self-destruction or leads to destruction of value, which they will never get back. There have been tensions in Benelux in general, not only in the Netherlands, about the banking sector.
The banking sector.
And this is an important sector. When you look at the middle class, it's an important sector. So if you start hitting the middle class, you will have less people going to the bank. You will have, in general, a poorer society. So, and this is not just the responsibility of governments. It's the responsibility at large of governments, businesses, together. And the digital transformation is not an easy take, because you might say, yes, but, I mean, others in the world are advancing. What shall I do? So I understand that. That's why not being easy, one should not lean for easy non-solutions. I mean, so I think the right approach to skill is be serious at all level and be serious also inside companies, not just in as a public task, because this is not just a public task.
Yeah. So in the digital world, there are more jobs than skilled people for the jobs. For many, many decades, people also think, well, digitalization leads to robotizing and leads to jobless growth. Is that true?
No. The simple answer is no. And now I try to give you a more sophisticated answer. If you look at what we were doing, how we were producing things 200 years ago, many of the things were manual, not really precise as products, not really safe. And imagine one would have said, this is the end of the work because the machines are coming. Things will improve. And by the way, you will not work anymore 14 hours per day, but only 8 or 10 per day. Ah, no possible. This will be the end of this society. So the society has transformed in a society that makes, in general, safer products, and people are treated more humanly.
Yeah, and we live longer.
Now, I don't think in the constitution of the world, in the constitution of Europe or the Netherlands, it's written that you have to work 40 hours per week.
No.
You might work a bit more, a bit less, but so...
And trade unions have struggled to get the 8-hour working day.
Yes, but you know why. Because, of course, it doesn't matter how long you work. What is really important is your productivity. And why is so important for
and
us?
Your well-being.
And your well-being. But the two things in Europe, we said it before, are very much linked. Because your well-being also, if we exclude those people which are enormously rich, is normally also linked to the functioning state.
So in some ways it's nice that some things are robotized.
Voilà. For many reasons. The first reason, I don't think we should ask human beings to do dangerous things. If it comes to cleaning a chemical tank, I think it's better we send a robot. I don't think all the jobs that are today offered on the market are really that human. It's much better than it used to be, but it could be much, much better. So robotizing job means more respect of the human being. And that's a very important step. The second step is to say, look, our society is becoming more productive. Thanks to robots, we can work a little bit less. Have you seen the new Finnish prime minister, which she was, by the way, the IT and telecom minister before?
Yeah.
She's thinking about reducing significantly the working time. So is it that dairy? If the output is the same, why not? But that, by the way, generates more jobs, because if people have more time, they go into leisure activities, tourism. For instance, you have seen the explosion of tourism, which is one of the big assets of Europe. They go in social activities. And you said it before, and by the way, since all becomes a bit healthier, and also the way we work, we live longer. So the silver economy also becomes bigger.
Yeah, and when you have more leisure time, maybe your creativity grows.
Exactly. So then maybe also you are with tasks which are a bit nicer than simply, doing repetitive jobs. And nice could be also technologically advanced. The two things are not in contradiction. We have a prize which is called STARS, which stands for Science and Technology and Art. And every year we give a prize, to something that gets together high technology and art.
Sounds nice.
Very nice. And last year, a Dutch startup won this prize. And they won it for a bridge, which is built through a 3D printer. And this bridge is in Amsterdam. So the idea was to integrate it in the environment of the center of Amsterdam. So to do something nice, but do something very advanced. So it's this tiny robot that prints the parts and solds the part together and creates the bridge. And at the same time, the shape is super nice. So it's exactly what you say. More time, more creativity, better way. This is not paradise. This is not a cheap, movie where I sell the paradise and in reality this horrible things, like, you know, this science fiction movie.
Yeah, at the start of this chat, we talked about our twin brother.
Exactly.
Is it possible that your twin brother can go into your office for a few days a week and you can do other
absolutely
things?
Yes, absolutely yes. That's what will happen. But there's a dark side, which I like now to highlight to you. So far, so good. I don't believe the story, more robots, less jobs, for all the reasons I explained. I don't believe the story, we are in this kind of drama society because of AI and automation. On the contrary, I believe to the story, we will be a safer, cleaner, and healthier society. But, let me go to the but of this story. You know that more and more kids are developing myopia. Myopia due to the fact that they are always looking at screens.
Oh, yeah.
This leads to retinitis. Retinitis could be a cause for blindness. And this has been seen in Korea, for instance, that people 25 years old, they start to be at risk to become blind.
25 years old already?
Yes. So there's a limit of how many hours people should look at the screen. There's a limit because you move less, because your eyes will be damaged. And I come to the other aspect, because also your social behavior might be affected. We had a meeting of a number of sociologists, neuroscientists very recently, because we are starting to ask them this question. Can you tell us if there's an association between behavior, human behavior, social behavior, and spending time on screen or spending time on social media? And definitely, we start to see that this association is there.
There is.
In terms of, for instance, again, talking of young people, behavior which can be more or less aggressive towards the others, behavior that might be more or less paranoid against what is going on. So we have a modern plague, which is the plague of disinformation. And this is due to many reasons. One reason you might be pleased to hear is that people like you, professional journalists, should be valued much more in our society, because nobody is a journalist without having a profession. I mean, not the fact that you publish a blog post, an email, doesn't make you a journalist. I mean, and this should be recognized by society. So the absence of giving enough value to professional journalists is one of the problems. But the other part of the problems is also the behavior of people towards all this. When we interact, social media are also nice because, of course, you can participate more to the democratic life. You can vote in your community or things you like.
Yeah,
you
and social like. Media not only help the normal citizen, but also the journalists themselves.
Absolutely. So the way it should be, for me, is that this is a mean, this is a tool to be better together. And it might be a fantastic tool, by the way. But when you eat popcorns in front of the social media, you think you are in a kind of horror movie, and in reality is the life, then things start to be distorted. Because in an horror movie, you want to be impressed. I mean, you want things that shake you up. You don't want to listen to this boring conversation that we are having. I'm not suggesting you listen, you go to the movie instead of listening to us. But what I'm trying to say is that entertainment is based on creating technically speaking, false emotions. I mean, because what you see is not real. And this is the problem right now. I mean, that there are people out there, some people out there, that exploit this idea of emotions, this idea of creating panic, fears, for a clear political purpose.
Yeah.
So, and there's no easy solution.
Now we're talking about disinformation and about intervening in election processes.
Exactly. So we have been doing a serious work. We continue. We have Vice President Jourová and the European Commission, which has this task to look at democracy and how to combat disinformation. In the previous commission, the commission has done a work with a group of experts that came with this kind of conclusion. It's not an easy subject. There's not a magic wand. I mean, we cannot say in the Hague the Dutch government creates the Ministry of Truth. People will, of course, laugh or be scared.
Yeah, many people will say, go away and stay away.
Exactly, because we don't accept anymore to be intermediated. I mean, soon we will not accept that the pilot flies the plane. I mean, we will do a kind of, who wants to fly? I mean, but this is, I mean, this example, everyone understands that they should be professionals. But the same is true for the information. I mean, a journalist is not somebody that hides the truth. It's a mediator. Gets things organized. It's the pilot of information. But then, of course, we fly all together. Now, my point being, one of the fundamental ways of combating disinformation is that people understand themselves what is their behavior, what is true, or what isn't, or how to navigate, which is something we have been trained at school for printed books. I mean, we know the history has been manipulated in the past. Information has been distorted for political, military reasons, whatever. We have learned it at school. We know it. We can recognize more or less the pattern. Nobody ever spoke to us, because maybe we passed the age, but now to young kids, social media. What about social media? So a very important point.
So children have to be eager to learn what social media can do for good, but also can do
they
in bad
have
ways.
To be empowered of navigating into this world and being alerted that things can be real, things cannot be real, that people might intentionally impress them, but with things which are not real. And this you learn by experience, by repeating, and by education. And this should be an integral part of the curriculum of the citizens of the future. Because we can have an army of journalists, an army of politicians, an army of bureaucrats telling the things, but, I mean, this is not enough if people are not convinced that there's a kind of protection or the kind of savviness they should have about what's going on.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, you were in Den Haag to talk with Dutch digital specialists. You told me already that you have some concerns about the Netherlands lagging behind in some ways. But is there a thing that already makes you happy when thinking about the Netherlands?
Oh, many things. Not the only the pannekoeken.
Pannekoeken.
No, many things. I mean, as I said, the Netherlands is in the top 10 of our special score when it comes to digitization of society. It's in the forefront with us in helping us in shaping the digital society and economy when it comes also to rules and things to be done. And it's a very, very important partner. Sometimes homework could be better, like in the case of 5G, but this is the exception rather than the rule. What I think it's important is that Netherlands, other member states, Europe in general realizes that we have now to invest in our future. I mean, because we talk about many things. But the bottom line being, as always in life, you can dream of a beautiful new car, but I mean, if you don't have the resources, you will not get there. Now, you can live, maybe even better, you live even better if you park your car and don't use it, but every now and then, why not? But point being, our digital ambitions, our ambitions of having a more modern Europe, a better Europe, that's a part which is also about spending a little bit, some good euros together. Now, I know that this is a very difficult discussion in the Netherlands, because basically, if I can simplify this discussion, seen from what I heard from many Dutch friends, we don't want to pay for the inefficiencies of Europe, if I can put it as a kind of bottom line.
Yeah. We would like to pay for technology, but not for bureaucracy.
Yes, which is correct. I mean, and I fully understand. But fighting bureaucracy does not happen without technology. So if you don't invest in the transformation of Europe, we never get there. The Netherlands has an impressive advantage to have access to the internal market. And this is an advantage that every Dutch citizen enjoys, one way or another. Whatever job, whatever activity in the Netherlands, as the Netherlands is the most beautiful example, has always been in the center, even more now, of a connector, a connected society. So that's impressive, and it will be even more in the future.
Yeah. Talking about investing, the Secretary General of the Dutch Ministry of Economic Affairs, Maarten Kamps, said last week, we better coordinate innovation through Brussels, because that's the only way to compete on a global scale. That must sound good in your ears.
Mr. Kamp is absolutely right. And that's what I said before. Challenges like, I mean, realizing together the new quantum computer, realizing together, I mean, a system that can control better what's going on in terms of understanding the climate of the Earth, systems like the new processor that can be implanted in your body, control your function. These are far too big things for a single country.
Yeah, and those are all examples where Europe can lead the digital world economy.
Exactly, but that's also if you don't like this story, because some of our listeners could say, "Wow, this is a usual person from Europe that says this kind of thing." I like to say something much more practical. When it comes to using the EU investment budget and the EU technology budget, the Dutch companies are always the best in class. Dutch universities, Dutch companies, they always score very, very high. So it's really, I mean, in a way, I cannot see where is the losing side, because it's good for the society, for the safety and the better health of the people, for the jobs, for the economy, for the academia. And, I mean,
In the Netherlands, we don't know how advanced we are already.
Well, I mean, you can consult our statistics. No, I think the point being that there's a plus in being part of Europe, which is so evident, especially in the Netherlands. It would be for me much more difficult to do the same interview maybe in some other parts of Europe, where I would say more the world in perspective, which I do believe, because there's no part of Europe that does not benefit from the European construction in different ways. But clearly, if there's a taker, and rightly so, because it's also a giver, that's the part which citizens sometimes don't accept. There's a take, which is the internal market, the advancement of technology, the synergies working together. There's a give, which is contributing to the European budget. But it's a give and take. You should not just look at the dry number, what goes in one direction or the other. There's a much larger economy and society consideration. So that's the message I'm trying to give to those of the brave people that are listening till the end of this.
So let's hope that our Prime Minister Mark Rutte and our Finance Minister Bob Koekstra are listening now.
I hope so.
Yeah. You are here without your twin brother, but maybe there will be one in the future.
Oh, yes.
But in about 10 or 15 years, there will be your successor here in this room, maybe. What will be the task of she or him, the main task?
I hope it will be a she. Difficult to say. I mean, I think to my predecessors of 10 years ago, you have seen maybe the pictures, I mean, of those people working in my office. This conversation would have sounded a mad people conversation. Disinformation on social media. What's social media? AI. What's AI? Stealing jobs? I mean, they would have said...
Maybe it was about roaming 10 years ago or so.
Yeah, it was about roaming, telecom infrastructure, a bit of robots here and there, but not really making the difference. So I think very difficult to say what will be this conversation 10 years from now. I suspect a little bit it will be about what will happen to our society, as I said before. So a society that will work less, that will think more, it will be more easily scalable. A society which, one way or another, is condemned to work together in a European way, condemned or as a pleasure. In case of Europe, it's a pleasure. Overall, we have to be connected together, but we have so many difficulties, I mean, on being together. So this kind of disruptive ways in our society will shape the future. But for sure, one thing they will discuss, and they will continue discussing, is access to data, moving the data around, using data. That's why our Commissioner Breton is insisting so much that this is important.
Yeah. And maybe your message for our listeners, and especially maybe for our young listeners, is keep on dreaming and try to implement what you dream about.
Absolutely. This is a strong message, and the message is exactly this. Don't listen. Don't listen if you have a dream to somebody says it will never happen. If you have a dream, it will happen. Don't listen. Don't be scared, especially if somebody's older than you, tells you, I listened too many times to this story, and it was the young people having the right answer, not the old people. So now I'm the category old people, so I refrain to give answers. I give interviews.
Roberto Viola, thank you very much for having this conversation.
Thank you very much to you. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Well, this was episode 78 of this podcast. The next episode, later this week, will be about the Dutch labor market. I then will have a conversation with Hans Borslap, who will present a vision on how to change the labor market in a modern and social way. Thank you for listening to this edition in English. Next time, we will speak Dutch. Deze aflevering van Betrouwbare Bronnen is mede mogelijk gemaakt door de Europese Commissie en door We Nederland.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Jansen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.